Good morning. What would life be like if the United States and the Allied forces had lost World War II? How would our lives be different if North America were the playing field in which Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan fought for dominance? How would a resistance movement survive in the midst of such conflict? Can you imagine such a world? This is the premise of a novel that was written years ago, but has recently been turned into a new TV series called The Man in the High Castle. It explores life in the United States as Germany and Japan fight to establish total control over this soil. It's a fascinating speculation of what life could have been like if history ended differently. And I think the reason it's so compelling is because it taps into a few things that are near and dear to us. First of all, Americans like to win. We think of ourselves as winners. We think that when we go to battle, we come out victorious. So to think, what if we'd lost this major conflict? What would that have done? And we're familiar with fighting, with struggle. We compete for popularity. We campaign to win. We fight to succeed. We're all about coming out on top. So can we even imagine a world in which two other forces were fighting and we had to sit back and watch? We're always struggling for power. Today we're continuing our preaching series in the life of David. We've called it A Life of Passion. We started it in August. It's a 10-month series working our way through the longest narrative except for Jesus in the entire scriptures. We started out seeing David discovered as a young shepherd boy. He was anointed king in a grand surprise, and then for years he was running for his life from the existing king, Saul, who was jealous and paranoid and out to kill him. Just before Christmas, we read of the death of Saul. And last week, as Jake alluded to, Brian Morgan led us through David's response to hearing of Saul and his son Jonathan's death. This man who'd been trying to kill David had finally died, and yet David didn't gloat, he didn't celebrate, he mourned the passing of the king's, of the Lord's anointed, the king of Israel. I had the experience this week of learning a friend of mine from high school who passed away, and I flew down to Houston for a day trip. And I had missed Brian Morgan's sermon last Sunday, but I got to watch the video on the plane, and that ministered to me, preparing to be with my friends, mourning the loss of one of our friends, and thinking about what it looks like to grieve biblically. But this week, we pick up in the second chapter of 2 Samuel. And when our story opens this morning, the period of mourning is over. It's time to move on. It's time to step forward and see what God has next for his people. David had been anointed years earlier. Saul is gone. He's out of the picture now. And so when the story opens, we wonder, could this be the moment we've been waiting for? Could this be the time that David is finally allowed to rule as king over God's people? But of course, it's not yet. Something else happens. Just as it looks like David might become king, something else happens to complicate matters even further. It turns out there is a new challenge for David. Saul is gone, but somebody else rises up, and what ensues is this battle for power. What we see is David's power struggle. For the past several years of David's story, we've seen his patience. We've seen him waiting for God to make good on his promise to make him king. We've seen him honor Saul, even when Saul didn't act like a king. And we've seen his steady trust in the face of persecution and oppression and injustice. But now, his path to the throne shows us something different. Now we see this even new sense of confidence and trust in what God has been doing. We see how David responds to this struggle for power, to the fight to come out on top. We see how David responds to competition. And it's a helpful story because these kinds of things happen to us all the time. This is the world we live in. We're constantly competing. We're constantly trying to win. We think that we're about to get there, and then there's another challenge. We butt heads with our bosses or our spouses or our children or our parents. And little things, little disagreements expand into epic battles to come out on top. How do we manage this? How do we live in a world that's constantly struggling for power? Let's see what we can learn from David in this story as he faces this and he shows us a different kind of way to handle it. Our story opens at this critical junction in the life of the nation of Israel. The king is dead. There's a vacuum for power. Who will step into that vacuum? The opening scene shows what David does first in that situation. Listen to 2 Samuel 2, verses 1 to 4. After this, that is the mourning of Saul and Jonathan, David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I go up into any of the cities of Judah?" And the Lord said to him, "Go up." David said, "To which shall I go up?" And he said, "To Hebron." So David went up there, and his two wives also, Ahinoam of Jezreel, and Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. And David brought up his men who were with him, everyone with his household, and they lived in the towns of Hebron. And the men of Judah came, and there they anointed David king over the house of Judah. Now, if you remember, David had been living among the Philistines in the city of Ziklag. So now that Saul is gone, he asks God. He begins by seeking God's will, saying, "What should I do? What's next?" He's probably asking yes or no questions. This is how people inquired of the Lord in ancient times. And so he probably suggests, "Should I go up to the city of Hebron?" And God says yes. So David moves from Ziklag with his men over to the city of Hebron, closer in towards the center of the nation of Israel. This is a significant city. This is where Abram first settled when God called him into the promised land. It's where Abraham's wife Sarah and son Isaac died and were buried. This is the city that God gave to Caleb, the young Israelite, when after 40 years of wandering, they finally entered into the promised land. So David is aware that this city is important. It's part of God's story. It's part of the long thread that God has been writing for his people from centuries earlier. But David settles there, and the men of Judah, the one tribe of Judah, anoints him as king. This is a starting point. It's an initial base from which David hopes to expand his rule into all of Israel. Notice how aware David is of God's story. There's this opportunity. Something is open. A door is open to him. And he begins by asking God what he should do. And then he goes to this place that lines up with all the things that God has done long before him. And he moves to this significant city. He seems to realize that his story, his personal story, is part of something much larger, part of a larger narrative that God's been writing. And so this awareness allows him then in his first act as king over one tribe to again take into account what has come before. Listen to the end of verse 4 through verse 7. When they told David it was the men of Jabesh-Gilead who buried Saul, David sent messengers to the men of Jabesh-Gilead and said to them, "May you be blessed by the Lord, because you showed this loyalty to Saul, your Lord, and buried him. Now may the Lord show steadfast love and faithfulness to you, and I will do good to you because you have done this thing. Now therefore let your hands be strong and be valiant, for Saul, your Lord, is dead, and the house of Judah has anointed me as king over them." David reaches out to this city. And again, this city is an important city. This city is the site of probably Saul's greatest moment. When Saul had first become king, this city was under attack, and Saul rallied the troops and saved them from their enemies. It was probably his best and maybe only kingly moment in his reign. So they had a reason to have this affection for Saul. So when the Philistines had killed Saul and hung his body up, they went, took his body, and gave him a proper burial. So David reaches out to them. He realizes these are Saul's biggest fans, and he crosses the aisle to reach out to them to express gratitude and thanks, and in a sense, to invite them onto his side, to gently say, I have grieved Saul as much as you have, but now God has made me king. Will you join me? Now, it's a brilliant move that David is doing. It's incredibly political to recognize that the most loyal fans of the previous administration is a perfect place to start to build your own power base, to reach out to them in gratitude for their honoring of Saul. So David is savvy, but he's not faking it. That's what's amazing. David is real. We just read a whole chapter of David's grief over Saul and Jonathan. He's not pretending for the sake of political gain. He's authentic. He's trying to build consensus. He's trying to build God's people and unite them under his rule. What's impressed us at various points, I think, as we've read through David's story, is his patience. His patience with what God is doing. And we see that same thing here. We see David aware of God's bigger story, moving into what God has for David, but continuing, even at this moment, to be patient. He doesn't dominate these people of Jabesh-Gilead. He doesn't assert his authority. He invites them to come along with him. What about us? Are we aware of God's story? Are we aware of what has gone before? And are we patient with what God is doing with us in the midst of that? Are we patient with God's story? David had already been anointed as king. He'd been running for years. Now was his moment. But he shows this restraint. He's aware of the breadth of God's work in the world. And he's waiting to find out how God continues in his life through that story. I think it's one of the most disconcerting and disorienting things about living in our culture is that people have simply lost the sense that they're part of some bigger story. We're just here. We're starting new things. It's all about the future. It's all about what could happen through me. There's no sense that people came before, that I'm part of a thread. And there's certainly no sense that God himself, the creator of the universe, is the one who has ordained those paths. I've been reading a daily devotional that I began this year called Awakening Faith. And it contains writings from people from about the 4th to 9th century who were followers of Jesus reflecting on their faith. And it's fascinating to hear these people reflecting what it looks like to follow Jesus in their culture and how powerful it is, how easily connectable it is to me. Especially in an age where my smartphone won't last me more than a year, to think that these writings have lasted thousands of years. This is the story that we are part of, the story that our lives are part of, the story that we're part of as followers of Jesus. Dan made allusion to the pastor elder retreat that we went on Friday night and all day Saturday. This is one of the questions we were asking. How do we as a church, as leaders of the church, honor the story that God has done here in this place? Because we as a church have a story. And how do we take part in that story, but also look forward and say, what is God going to do with us in the future? We have no idea. We want it to be connected with what God has done, but not shackled by what God has done. What does that look like? How is God using us in our story? David is patient. He's patient to see how this plays out in his life. But it doesn't take long for that patience to be tested. Because just as he recognized this power vacuum and stepped into it, the remnant of Saul's court sees it as well. Remember that at this point, only the tribe of Judah has crowned David as their king. Now somebody else rises up, a new rival who threatens him. Listen to verses 8 through 11. But Abner, the son of Ner, commander of Saul's army, took Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim. And he made him king over Gilead and the Asherites and Jezreel and Ephraim and Benjamin and all Israel. Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, was 40 years old when he began to reign over Israel, and he reigned 2 years but the house of Judah followed David. And the time that David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years and 6 months. So we had this commander, Abner, who was from Saul's court. And just as David asserted himself, just as he moved into Hebron, Abner recognizes an opportunity, and he takes the chance to install someone else as king. Now, it's very clear from the beginning that Ish-bosheth, the man who becomes king, is simply a puppet. Abner does all the heavy lifting. Abner takes him. Abner makes him king. Abner establishes him in this city. And Abner chooses Mahanaim as the new headquarters for this king. And you can see that this city is over soon across the Jordan River. This is the city not in the center of God's land. This is on the other side of the river. And if you remember the story, God never intended this part to be part of the promised land. When the Israelites first conquered, some of them had settled there and they asked God, can we stay here? And he gave that to them as a concession. So what Abner does is he moves the people away as David is moving people forward. See, David is aware of God's story. He's acting in line with God's story. But Abner is writing his own story. He's on his own. He has his own plans, his own agenda. He installs a puppet king so that he can assert his authority. He's acting on his own. I think sometimes we're more like Abner than like David. Do we act on our own? To be fair, this is the way we're taught to act. This is how our culture trains us to recognize an opportunity, to see what needs to be done, to assert ourselves, to step in, to make sure that our ideas win, that everything happens according to our plan, to control other people, control the environment, and dominate. This is Abner. This is the way we're taught. We are told that what is in front of us is the most important thing. What came before matters not at all. I remember one particular meeting that I attended when I was in software development. And it was a meeting between two development teams. And I was part of one team. I was kind of a lowly designer on one team. And I had an idea. I'm an idea person. I like ideas. And of course, I thought my idea was brilliant, right? I'm sure it was. And I had emailed the other team about it. And I received back from one of the directors of that team kind of a critical and harsh response that I didn't understand. And of course, I was naive of all the power dynamics that were at play between these two development teams, so I just thought my idea was great, and I didn't understand why they didn't think it was great, too. But I remember preparing for this meeting and just feeling like, I'm ready for this fight. I'm going to go, and I'm going to show those people that my idea is the best idea. And I remember feeling like the outcome of that meeting would determine my entire life. I mean, this was my identity, and I was going to win. You ever feel like that? Like you have to have your way come out. This is Abner. This is what he's doing, writing his own story, totally unaware of what God is doing, insisting that his plans come about. So David and Abner had very different approaches to handling this power vacuum. And of course, with two kings, eventually conflict would arise. And that's exactly what happens. Abner and his puppet Ish-bosheth are trying to expand their kingdom over all of Israel, and that puts them into conflict with David. And so there's this scene. It's a long scene of a battle that progresses between a couple of different stages between Abner and his men and Joab, who represents David's rule. We'll start off by reading verses 12 to 17. Abner, the son of Ner, we're going to put Abner on this side, and the servants of Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, went out from Mahanaim to Gibeon. And Joab, over here, the son of Zeruiah, and the servants of David, went out and met them at the pool of Gibeon. And they sat down, the one on one side of the pool, and the other on the other side of the pool. And Abner said to Joab, "Let the young men arise and compete before us." And Joab said, "Let them arise." Then they arose and passed over by number 12 for Benjamin and Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, and 12 of the servants of David. And each caught his opponent by the head and thrust his sword in his opponent's side, so they fell down together. Therefore, that place was called Helkath Hazarim, which is at Gibeon. And the battle was very fierce that day, and Abner and the men of Israel were beaten before the servants of David. So what's happening is these two armies are meeting to battle, and Abner makes a suggestion. It's similar to what happened in the story of David and Goliath. Let's let these young warriors compete as representatives of our army and let them decide the battle. So 12 men from each side arise, signifying the unity that they were trying to attain, to unite the 12 tribes under one leader. And they fought, but as it turns out, all 24 died in that battle. There was no obvious victor. So something else had to happen. And what happens is the struggle then for power turns from a national one to a personal one. Verse 18 to 23. And the three sons of Zeruiah were there. Joab, that's David's commander, Abishai, and Asahel. Now Asahel was swift of foot as a wild gazelle. And Asahel pursued Abner. And as he went, he turned neither to the right hand nor to the left from following Abner. Then Abner looked behind him and said, "Is it you, Asahel?" And he answered, "It is I." Abner said to him, "Turn aside to your right hand or to your left and seize one of the young men and take his spoil." But Asahel would not turn aside from following him. And Abner said again to Asahel, "Turn aside from following me. Why should I strike you to the ground? How then could I lift up my face to your brother Joab?" But he refused to turn aside. Therefore Abner struck him in the stomach with the butt of his spear so that the spear came out at his back. And he fell there and died where he was. And all who came to the place where Asahel had fallen and died stood still. Remember that all these people had served together under Saul, so they knew each other, but now they were divided by these two different kings. And so Asahel was the youngest brother of these three. He was inexperienced, but he was fast. So he saw this opportunity, and he said, "I can catch this guy, and if I defeat Abner, then this whole thing is over." So he runs and chases him, and Abner knows that Asahel is no match for him. So he says, "Come on, Asahel, don't do this. Attack one of the younger men. Have an easy win. Don't make me kill you." But Asahel insists. So Abner uses an old military trick and stops short in his tracks and pushes his spear back. And Asahel's strength of his speed becomes his weakness. And he's impaled on the spear and dies. Now, Abner was trying to do the right thing. He was trying to talk Asahel out of this, but it didn't work. So now we have a brother who is dead, and this personal issue becomes an issue of vengeance. Story continues in verse 24. But Joab and Abishai, the brothers of the fallen Asahel, pursued Abner. And as the sun was going down, they came to the hill of Ammah, which lies before Gaia on the way to the wilderness of Gibeon. And the people of Benjamin, that is Abner and his men, gathered themselves together behind Abner and became one group and took their stand on the top of a hill. Then Abner called to Joab, "Shall the sword devour forever? Do you not know that the end will be bitter? How long will it be before you tell your people to turn from the pursuit of their brothers?" And Joab said, "As God lives, if you had not spoken, surely the men would not have given up their pursuit of their brothers until the morning." So Joab blew the trumpet, and all the men stopped and pursued Israel no more, nor did they fight anymore. So the brothers try to avenge Asahel's death. They pursue Abner, but Abner takes the high ground on top of a hill and says, "Come on, this is only going to end in more bloodshed. Let it go." And Joab is convinced, and he does. And as the story ends, each side disperses and returns to their home base. Verses 29 to 32. And Abner and his men went all that night through the Arabah. They crossed the Jordan, and marching the whole morning, they came to Mahanaim. Joab returned from the pursuit of Abner. And when he had gathered all the people together, there were missing from David's servants 19 men besides Asahel. But the servants of David had struck down of Benjamin 360 of Abner's men. And they took up Asahel and buried him in the tomb of his father, which was at Bethlehem. And Joab and his men marched all night, and the day broke upon them at Hebron. So everybody disperses. Overall, the servants of David won this battle. 20 dead on their side to 360 dead on the other. And you get the sense that the moment has found some peace, but this isn't really resolved. Vengeance hasn't been done. The rivalry between these two factions has paused, but it's not over. And next week we'll see how that ends up resolving. But let's think about Abner and think about his actions. He's not the good guy in this story by any means, but I think the way he's described makes us somewhat sympathetic to him. Three times, Abner made an effort to limit the bloodshed of this conflict. First, it was his suggestion that instead of the armies fighting, we have representatives fight. That was a way to limit the killing. That failed. So then Asahel pursues him, and he begs Asahel, this is the second time, please, don't do this. That didn't work. And in the third case, he mounts to the top of this hill, and he calls over to Joab, this is only going to end in bitterness. Please, let go of this fight. And finally, he's able to end the conflict for now. So Abner is trying to do the right thing. He's trying to be a nice guy. But you get the sense he's this kind of tragic character because he's the one that started it all. He's the one that insisted on his plans. He's the one that installed Ishbosheth as king. He started off on the wrong foot, and now he's trying to make his plans work but be as nice about it as possible. And it turns out that you can't be ignorant of the story of God. You can't insist on your way. You can't pursue your own agenda for the sake of gaining power, but do it nicely. It just doesn't work. Abner wants to minimize his power struggle, but he can't escape it. He's trapped by himself. You ever feel that way? How do you handle a power struggle? How do you hold yourself when you enter into that kind of a conflict? Think about Ishbosheth. He's the puppet king, and he's just absent. He's not even involved. He's off in the back of the story. Sometimes I think we do that. We just say, it's too complicated. It's too messy. I'm just going to let other people do all the hard work. I'm just going to keep my head down, and I won't even get involved. Maybe you're like that. Or maybe you're like Abner, and you get in the middle of it, and you know you can win, and you get prepared, and you insist on your way, and you assert yourself until you come out on top. But then there's David. And David shows us something different. There's some new way. There's some third option that David represents to us. It's compelling. It turns out that it's the same way that the son of David would react 1,000 years later when he was caught in the middle of a power struggle. Listen to the dialogue between Jesus of Nazareth and Pontius Pilate, the man who would eventually order Jesus' execution. Pontius had asked Jesus where he was from, and Jesus stayed silent. This is how it played out. This is John 19, verses 10 through 11. So Pilate said to him, "You will not speak to me? Do you not know that I have authority to release you and authority to crucify you?" Jesus answered, "You would have no authority over me at all unless it had been given you from above." See, Jesus knew that he was part of God's story. He knew that God was the one with all the authority, that any power that happens on this plane, that any of the little dynamics that get played out, they all happen underneath the umbrella of God, who is all-powerful. Pilate recognized that. He saw that Jesus knew something different. That's why when Pilate did put him on the cross, he painted a sign that said, "Jesus, King of the Jews." And everybody said, "Don't say he was king, say he claimed to be king." And Pilate said, "I've written what I've written." Because he saw that Jesus knew what David knew. As we think about our lives, we want to be like that. We want to be like David. We want to be patient. We want to rise above the power struggle. But it's hard. Where do we turn when our friendships turn into rivalries? How do we redeem a marriage that turns into a constant struggle for control? How do we live in a family that seems like power dynamics are everywhere, among siblings, parents and children, and extended family, and everybody's just fighting to come out on top? Where do we turn in the midst of a power struggle? We turn to Jesus, the King of the Jews, who redeems our need to win. Jesus gives us that third option. With Jesus at the center of our lives, we don't have to struggle for power. We're free. We can make Jesus the center of our story. This is what the world around us desperately needs. Our culture is full of people like Abner. There's no sense that they're connected to any greater story. They're writing their own story. There's no sense that they can do anything except act on their own because there's nobody else to act for them. They have to win. They have to come out on top. Anything else would be complete devastation because there's nothing else except for them. This is the world we live in. But when we have faith in Jesus, when he is the center of our story, then there is no power struggle. You're free. That's the message of the gospel. Jesus Christ is Lord. We don't have to be. And as much as we think we want to be Lord, we really don't want that responsibility. We want to be free. We want to submit ourselves to God, to accept his love and forgiveness and inclusion, and be a part of his kingdom. That's the freedom the gospel offers. And when we live like that, when we're able to not engage that power struggle and recognize that there is something else, people notice. They say, why is it that you don't always have to win when everybody else is clawing their way to the top? What is it about you? Why are you free from what seems to dominate everybody else around us? Do people see that in us? Do they recognize that freedom, that we live with Jesus as our Lord? And that gives us this third path of escaping the power struggle. Can we rest in God's story instead of writing our own? There is a battle going on in our world today. It's actually not that different from what might happen if Nazi Germany and Imperial Japan were fighting for control on our land. Our very lives are the battleground. Jesus is building his kingdom. He is establishing his loving rule over all that would put their faith in him. But it's a battle that can easily be lost if you try and fight your own way, if you try and insist on writing your own story. After the first service, somebody came up to me and asked me, whatever happened with that meeting? And I said, you know, I can't even remember. All I remember is how important it was to win, but I don't even remember if I did. So many of the things in our lives, they're just not that important, but they seem like it. The only way to really win is to live out faith in Jesus, to put him at our center and recognize that we don't have to struggle for power. The gospel of Jesus Christ frees us from the struggle for power. So be encouraged by David's story this morning. For this morning, David is an example to us. Recognize the story God has told before you. Recognize all the forces that came together to bring you here today, this morning, in this place, and hear this message, and ask the question, what is God doing from here? How is God's story going to continue to be played out in my life? Rest in the knowledge that God has gained the victory, so we don't have to. Make Jesus the center of your life and escape the struggle for power. Amen.